secular, literary writing is coterminous with the rebirth of the state itself. And we assume that it was the creation of Israel which caused Hebrew to come again alive and to move from a holy language into a living language. This is not the case. Actually, when Israel was first founded some 80 years ago, when the issue began, those settlements, which were sponsored by the Alliance Israélite Universelle, the French settlements, Petah Tikva, Rishon LeZion, spoke French. The German-sponsored settlements spoke German. Those who came to Israel to mourn for the plight of our people and to pray at the Wailing Wall for the early coming of the Messiah spoke Yiddish. The small Sephardic settlements spoke either Ladino, the Sephardic Yiddish, Arabic. Hebrew was simply not spoken, except in the synagogue at prayer. Indeed, when 60 years ago, Theodore Herzl wrote a rather romantic, prophetic novel of what the new state would look like, he gave a graphic description of its technology and its politics, he neglected to indicate that the people would be speaking Hebrew. He seemed to believe that the Israeli would speak German, his language and the language of technology, of engineering, 20th century. Point of fact, the rebirth of Hebrew as a spoken tongue, as a vehicle of secular communication, goes back to Central Europe, to the late 18th and early 19th centuries, to a group of intellectuals, a small minority of Jews, who used Hebrew, of all things, as a tool of assimilation. They were determined to bring the Eastern Jewish masses out of their superstitious milieu, out from their ignorance and their meanness of spirit, to open to them the treasuries of Western civilization, which are obviously superior to their way of life. And they selected Hebrew as the vehicle for their instruction. These men were called the Maskilim, the enlightened ones. Pedagogically, they used Hebrew because Hebrew was not too alien to the Jewish mass. Yiddish, when it was written with Hebrew letters. The sound of Hebrew had been heard, and they felt they could sort of sneak in Kant and Hegel and Rousseau if they simply translated their works into Hebrew. So the revival of Hebrew, surprisingly, is due to the deliberations and machinations of a group of academic Jews who were dissatisfied with the average way of Jewish life, despised Hasidism, who felt that the Jew was in his poor, huddled shtetl, benighted, medieval. And they looked on Hebrew as one of the key vehicles by which the Jew would be brought into the 19th century. This is readily admitted. One of the late Maskilim, Abraham Geiger, had this to say. Had they written in pure German, these works would have remained incomprehensible. Or if the medium had been the Jewish dialect, he couldn't bring himself to say Yiddish. The growth of the aesthetic spirit would have been stillborn among our kinsmen. Yiddish was looked upon by these Maskilim as an anathema, as having contributed, one said, to the unmannerliness of the common man. Hebrew had the advantage for them of being familiar, at least in sound, and of overleaping in its traditions the entire medieval rabbinic world. Hebrew was associated with biblical times, when Jews were kings and princes, and when a Jew could stand tall without any restrictions, and also with the so-called Golden Age in Spain in the 10th, 11th, and 12th centuries, when the Jew was very much a part of the very highly cultured Arab world of the day. These two images delighted the Basculin, the kind of Jew who could walk the streets of Paris, and London, and New York, and feel in no way inferior to the cultivated Westerner. This was their ideal, and Hebrew was the vehicle of their program. So Hebrew begins as a renewed language, as a tool of assimilation. And Hebrew is used during the 19th century as a tool of social criticism. These early Maskilim wrote our learned articles. They wrote textbooks and primers in Hebrew. In the middle of the 19th century, a group, small group of Russian Jews began to write novels in Hebrew. And the novels that they wrote were novels of protest, of criticism, of bitter satire. The average theme centered on the court of a tzaddik, one of the wunder rabbis, one of the wonder-working leaders of the Hasidic community around whom all of the Jews thronged, a man who could work miracles and perform faith cures. And the usual theme of the novel was this, that his grandson, who was in line for the succession, would come across a book by a German philosopher or by some scientist, and this book would open to him the magic, the wide horizons of Western civilization, open his eyes to the meanness, the ignorance of the Hasidic court. And he would begin to pull away from his family, pull away from his background. Ultimately, he would flee to Paris. And that's usually where the novel ended. There was a man by the name of S.A. Abramovitz, who was better known among Jews as Mendel Mocher Sforim, Mendel the bookseller. He wrote in Yiddish most of his life, but his first novel was in Hebrew. He was one of these men who sought to criticize the ignorance of the Jewish mass of Eastern Europe. And it was entitled, typically, Fathers and Sons. It dealt with this generational conflict by the skill or the interest or the talents or the purpose of the writer. The only thing which makes Hebrew literature interesting to us is that it offers us a mirror into the soul of the modern Israeli, and to watch and see how much of its magnetism, of its magic remains. Whether as a phenomenon which is associated with so much that is of importance to us in our tradition, it has the power to call men back from the secular world, to call men back from the literary jet set, the people who would far better rather be on the left bank or in Greenwich Village than in Jerusalem. Hebrew then begins not in the land of Israel, but outside of Israel. And Hebrew is learnt in the diaspora and taught to Israel, and taught quite deliberately and for a very practical purpose. The father of modern Hebrew is known as Eliezer ben Yehuda. Was not the language which made sense was Hebrew, because it was the only one writing the great, vast Milon dictionary, a term he himself coined from the word Milah, from the term Milah, word, which gave Israel so much of the language and free reign in writing that language which it now has. Now, why was Hebrew the one language which could give Israel unity? Well, in the French schools, teachers delighted to teach French, but obviously no good Frenchman would teach German. But in the Hillsparine schools, where German was the language, every good German teacher immigrated to Israel was delighted to teach German. He was damned if he was going to teach French. And in the yeshivot in Jerusalem, where Yiddish was the language of instruction, and Aramaic and Hebrew, an Aramaized Hebrew, the language of advanced instruction, they weren't about to learn Arabic. And in the Sephardic community, where they taught their Talmud in Aramaic, Hebrew, and in Arabic, they were not about to learn Yiddish. And so the only way in which you could get any unity was to find a common denominator, the historical denominator, Hebrew. And there were great battles in early Israel about the use of Hebrew as the national language. In the early 1800s, there were 1880s rather, there were a group of secret societies in Israel, of people, nice people, obviously, who had to band together to make agreements that they would speak only Hebrew among themselves, in their families, in the marketplace, wherever they met. Hebrew was almost a subversive language for a while. And then in the 1890s, the teaching profession in Israel began to realize that unless they made a decision on behalf of Hebrew, their best efforts were going to waste. Because though all elementary schools could work in each settlement, all elementary schools were in every single settlement and could be controlled by the settlement, the more advanced schools drew from many settlements. And you had to have a common language. And that common denominator had to be Hebrew. The battle was finally decided in 1913. The Technion in Haifa was established largely by German money and German interest. 1913 represents, as you know, the high water mark of pan-Germanism. The Kaiser was bestride his horse and determined to bestride Europe. And the good German-Jewish burghers in Berlin and Hamburg who had given the money to the Technion were determined that the language of instruction in the Technion should be German. How did the young boy who had been raised in Petah Tikva in French enroll in the Technion, which at that time was the only advanced school in Israel? And so the teachers in Petah Tikva, at Rishon LeZion, and in Jerusalem, where Yiddish was the language, went on a general strike. And they said that we won't begin to teach again until we have an agreement that all the schools of higher education in Israel will teach Hebrew. And after some pressure was brought by some people in the United States who didn't speak Hebrew but could see its advantage, the German group finally made a compromise. Physics and chemistry the first year would be taught in Hebrew. After 4 years, all the instruction would be in Hebrew. And that compromise, ending in the triumph of Hebrew, set the seal of the dominance of Hebrew as a language of instruction in Israel. Now there were, of course, men like Eliezer ben Yehuda, more importantly, Aharon, who in the 1880s and 1890s and 1910s recognized that Hebrew had a value which far transcended any pragmatic consideration. They looked upon Israel not simply as a haven for the refugee, not simply as a place of last resort for those who were not admitted as citizens in any other country, but they looked on it as a great opportunity for Jewry to have a new birth, a renewal. They felt Jews congregating in their own land, determining their destiny, speaking the language of their ancestors, coming to grips with their history, that such a Jewry would give a dramatic new dimension to Jewish life. But what about the problem of the shallowness of the idiom? That Hebrew had the Bible, but the Bible is limited literature. It had the prayer literature, but again, that's only derived its vocabulary from one area of life. There was some secular poetry written by the Spanish Jewries of the Middle Ages. But beyond that, Hebrew didn't have the dimension, the breadth, the ambit it required. Aharon used to quote Cato. Cato believed that classical Latin, rather than the popular Roman, must be the language of communication in ancient Rome. And when he was asked, well, how can we express all we need to express in Latin? He answered with the phrase, rem tenor, verba sequentur. First have your original thought. That's something to say. You'll find the means to say it. And that proved to be the case. And the way in which Jews carved out a new language is fascinating. Obviously, there were no trains in biblical days, nor in Talmudic days, nor in the medieval times. How do you find a word for a train? We look in the Bible. Obviously, everything's in the Bible. And you find in the Bible the phrase in the prophet Ezekiel, Markevet Esh, which is a word Ezekiel uses when he's in a trance one day and he sees a heavenly vision and there's a chariot of fire. Markevet Esh. Well, there were some purists who were a little troubled by this because Ezekiel didn't mean a train when he spoke of a Markevet Esh. And they coined a word, Tahalucha, which means the self-propelled. It comes from the word halak, to go. But a lot of things in modern life are self-propelled. So this didn't quite satisfy anybody. Somebody else began writing about Shurat Masa, the rails that carry you along. Well, that satisfied people for a while, but finally they weren't satisfied either with that, and they came to the word which is used today, simply Rakevet, which is a shortening of the Ezekiel term, and has something of the sound of the wheels and the pistons moving along as the train clatters over the tracks. Hebrew is a fascinating language. Some words in Hebrew are borrowings, direct borrowings from English. The word tragedy in Hebrew is tragedia. Some words are borrowing from two languages. You know what they call in Hebrew a man who manages to find his way through the intricacies of the bureaucracy? He manages to get behind the desk to know what's going on. It's called a jobnik. The English job, almost from the way the burglars, you know, have a job to do. And nik is a Slavic, you know, a person who does something. Or you take the word in Hebrew for a motor scooter. You know the word katan, small. Noah means to move about. So they created a blender to get a katnoah, a little thing that scoots about. And you get the word scooter. Well, Hebrew developed, obviously, out of necessity, its own language. It was a little easier to develop Hebrew than it would have been to develop English, because English is a very complicated language. And Hebrew, basically, is a very regular language. All words come from certain three rooted letters, three basic letters. And you can make nouns and verbs and adjectives and adverbs out of the same letters. So Hebrew had a great deal of built-in flexibility to it. And the poets and writers of Israel have exploited that flexibility to the utmost. Now, Hebrew, I said, in its origin was a language revived in order to acculture the Jew to the 20th century. And for the first part of its history, that's precisely one of the functions it performed. Most books which have been written in Hebrew, the overwhelming majority, are translations from all languages of the world. They say that there are some 2,000 books which are published in Israel every year. Well over 1,500 of these are translations. And if you go into any Tel Aviv or Jerusalem bookstore, you can find everything from Shakespeare to James Bond and probably some of the lesser desired works which appear on our bestseller list. If we wanted to go to the theater in Israel tonight, we were in Tel Aviv, you know what our choice would be? At the Habima, they're showing Terence Rattigan and Separate Tables in Hebrew. At the Chamber Theater, the Kameri, they're showing Clifford Odets Country Girl in Hebrew. And what we would call an off-Broadway theater, they're showing a Hebrew program called Love and All That Jazz. The Hebrew University publishes a series of occasional papers which is called a scripta, the last volume of which was done by the literary faculty of the Department of Humanities and included long essays on Brecht's Waiting for Godot, on Chekhov's The Cherry Orchard. The Israeli literary world is international and cosmopolitan. Hebrew is a language which does not limit the Jew to his time and his place, the small country of Israel, or to his tradition. But it has built into it a tradition. And the tension between the history of the language and the desire of those who use the language to be heard far beyond the borders of Israel is one of the great tensions of modern Israeli literature. One of the characters you meet and you become familiar with in Israeli novels is a young man, a bohemian type, verbal, vocal, creative, who inhabits the bistros of Tel Aviv, who wants to use his native language but wants to have very little to do with the past or even with the present. He wants to write of love. He wants to write in the style of Kafka or the style of Brecht or in the non-style of some of our modern writers. And he feels restricted by the language, restricted by the audience he can appeal to because of the language he uses. But most of all, he'd much rather be on the left bank or in Greenwich Village, really, than in Tel Aviv. And there are these uprooted people among Israeli intelligentsia, writers, young writers, quite as much as there are such people, obviously, in the United States and elsewhere. Indeed, from the very beginning, there were Jews who caught the assimilative capacity of the Hebrew language and tried to use it still in Israel as a vehicle to force the Jew into a different mold. Among the great pioneers of modern Hebrew literature is a poet, translator by the name of Saul Chernyakhovsky. Chernyakhovsky was born in Russia. He was tutored in Hebrew at an early age. But from his early age to his death, he keeps referring to himself as a strange plant among his fellow Jews. He couldn't feel at home. He lived in an age in which men delighted to say that there's such a thing as a Hellene and such a thing as a Hebrew. There's a Jewish tradition and a Greek tradition. The Greek tradition exalts nature and the sensual and the aesthetic. The Jewish tradition exalts obedience to God, meditation, sanctification, the intellectual, the introspective. He opted for the Greek. One of his great series of poems is called Sonnets of a Pagan. He spent a great deal of his life translating into Hebrew the Iliad, the Odyssey, the Rig Veda, the Icelandic Eddas, Moliere, Ossian, Goethe, Shakespeare, you name it, he translated it. He was determined that he was going to bring to Israel and bring to the Hebrew-speaking Jew the entire glory of Western civilization. He seemed to believe that this was his purpose to being, and being something of a genius, he had the language, the skill with which to do it. His descendants, there are many. Many who feel that they'd like to use Hebrew to join the Western world, not to be separated out by it. And there are many who, though they are Sabras, Israeli born, and though they are fully Israeli, believe that there is nothing which they share with the entire range of tradition which somehow Hebrew symbolizes. There's a small group of writers who call themselves the Canaanites. They won't be called Israelis. They won't be called Jews. They're pagans, and they're proud of it. They're heathens, Canaanites, those whom our ancestors pushed away because they worshiped nature gods, because they had sexual rites associated with their temples. Well, they delight in the physical and in the natural, and they delight in the idea that they are pagans. But have you ever seen a Jewish pagan? You've seen quite a beast. Now, Hebrew, modern Israeli literature, seems to me, divides essentially into two basic generations. There's an immigrant generation, which comes early or late in its life, generally having learned Hebrew in the diaspora, which has more or less capacity to control the language, but whose entire thought world is conditioned by the European environment. The greatest of the Hebrew writers, Chaim Nachman Bialik, is such a man. Bialik was born in the Pale of the Settlement. Bialik learned Hebrew as in his own way. He carved out a living language for himself. He wrote his greatest poetry before he came to Israel. And even when he was in Israel, his themes tended to revert back to the Matmid, to the perpetual student whom he remembered from the yeshiva in Volozhin, to the unmarked graves of the martyrs of the Kishinev pogrom. His world was the world of the Jewry that he knew. And you don't find in him the exaltation of the new Jew, a homeless in Zion. He's still at home in the old world. And then there's a new generation, a generation of young writers who are born in Israel, who came to Israel sufficiently young so they feel rooted. And they look at the world from an entirely different perspective. They ask the questions, what does it mean to me as an Israeli, rather than what does it mean to me as a European Jew? No problem has disturbed Jewry the world over as much as the problem of the Holocaust, the destruction of such things. How do you relate to it? How can you relate to it? The elderly generation set up lamentations. They bewailed the martyrs. They remembered the streets of the cities in which they had born. They saw ghosts walking those streets. The younger generation wondered about its own reactions, being trained to be those who will avenge indignity to the Jewish people. So you have a man like Hanoch Bartok, wrote a prize-winning novel several years ago, which has been translated into English under the title The Brigade. He tells an interesting story. You see, the unit in the Palestine Brigade of the Jews who fought in the British Army during the Second World War. D-Day has taken place. There's been triumph in Europe. And this unit, which has been in Italy, has been ordered into Germany as part of the army of occupation. And when these orders come down, you feel an electric excitement through the troops. And one of them says, we're going to have a wild Jewish revenge. For once, we're going to be the Cossacks. We're going to be the Tartars. We're going to be the Germans. And they finger their guns, and their hands are on the trigger. And you go with this unit as in its lorry as it approaches Germany. And you can see that they're waiting for that first moment when they're free of their officers. The blood is in their eyes. They're Canaanites. They're not Jews anymore. They're not going to take it anymore. And then you watch the young protagonist of the story. His name is Elias. He stomps off to town, his carbine over his shoulder. A German approaches him and whispers to him, that house over there, it belongs to an officer of the SS. He's away, and his wife and daughter are there. He thinks of rape. He thinks of attack. He thinks of vengeance. He kicks in the door of the house. And there's the woman and her daughter cowering in the kitchen. And he finds out that he's not so much a Canaanite. He finds the only thing he asks this woman, though the urge for vengeance is in every throb of his heart, is for a room to stay in for the night, clean sheets, something he hasn't had during the war. He goes upstairs to the child's room, he and a buddy. And during the night, they hear noises downstairs. Other non-Israeli members of the army of occupation have entered the house, and they're wrestling with these women. And despite himself, he finds himself going downstairs and ordering these men out of the house, his gun in hand. He's protecting these members of the SS. He's not convinced, Elias or Bartok, that this is a heroic act. He's not convinced that he's not a coward. He's not convinced that this overlay of civilization is good, but he is convinced that he can't be the pagan. And in that tension, you have a very, very effective and dramatic story, and something which I think explains what we saw in June of this year after the victory of the Six-Day War. You have two generations then, a generation whose emotional world remains the world of Europe, and a generation whose emotional world is now the new world of Israel, seeking its own roots. The first generation, when it comes to Israel, if it deals with an Israeli theme, deals with it idyllically. There's the past. Here I can walk through Jerusalem, I can walk through Modin, where Mattathias raised the rebellion of the Maccabees. You have men who write the great historical romances of the past. In the new generation, you have the men who wonder whether they really want to live under the burden of the past. There's a fascinating book which has been written in Israel called Hachai Al-Hamet, by a man who is in his 50s today. Hachai Al-Hamet means the living upon the dead. The Megid who wrote this book sets up the situation. There's a young Tel Aviv Bohemian. He claims to have no values. He's an existentialist. He believes only in himself and in the moment. But you've got to live. And he finds after a while that his money's running out, and he's quick with a pen, facile, and a publisher approaches him to write a biography of one of the great pioneers. And he takes a rather sizable advance and puts him back in food and in liquor. And he feels that he can toss out this biography in a matter of days. So he goes back to his haunts at night, and during the day he does some desultory work in the library. He meets some of those who knew this pioneer. The living on the dead. Now the dead man was a man who knew how to sacrifice. He's a very simple, heroic kind of figure. He left his European background. He came, and with his hands he worked the soil. Out of his sweat he made one of the kibbutzim green. He He kept the people together. He gave them life. He gave them encouragement. There was an unusual dignity to this man. And this young cynic, despite himself, is attracted by the tradition, attracted by the past. And the more he vacillates between these two worlds, the very effete, very sophisticated world of the youth, and the rather simple, open-air, pioneering world of his subject, the more he becomes confused, filled with self-doubt, and in fact, paralyzed. He's called Jonas. The name is symbolic. Symbolic, of course, of the prophet Jonah, the prophet who was sent to Nineveh to tell the people of Nineveh that they are to die, and when the people repent and God recalls his decision, remember Nineveh, Jonah complains of God's change of heart. But Jonah, when the first call had come early in that story, tried to flee from it. There's no call of God in this story. Rather, there's a court summons. The publisher has gone to court. He demands something for the advance he has given the writer. And young Jonas is told to sit down and to complete his assignment. But he's paralyzed. The story ends in that sense of paralysis. His young generation is as sophisticated as any. The Hebrew, the Bible, the tradition, the pioneers of the earlier generation, somehow they cannot be escaped. And many a modern Israeli writer, younger writer, I think, finds himself in that tradition. Now, of course, among the modern Israeli authors, there are a number who deal with themes which are common to Western civilization. After all, the urbanization, the growing academic requirements, the growing specialization of the city, as much a part of Cleveland as of Tel Aviv, Haifa as of New York. There's another story by Megid, which is a rather fascinating one, which deals with this kind of universal theme. It's called The Fool. And the non-hero, because most of modern fiction has the non-hero, the little man, caught in the web of his time, unsure, confused, pushed here, pushed there, having only a flicker of inner dignity veiled largely from him by his own confusion. This little non-hero seeks to find his way in a confusing world. Now, the modern Israeli lives not on the kibbutz, but in the city. And his world is not the world of those who broke the stone and made the hills green. His world is the world of the auditors and of the secretaries and of the bureaucrats and of the technicians and of the engineers who build the sinews of a modern state. Now, the fool is an auditor, very low in some office. And he sees all about him bright young people being very sophisticated, being very superior to the traditional values. He begins to wonder about these values. He's not sure if it's a dream or if it's reality. He suddenly sees a group of rather middle-class people coming together for a meeting. There's a secretary, there's a president, somebody calls for the minutes to be read, somebody claims their name isn't spelled properly. And it's a society for the promulgation of sin. It's the reverse of the ordinary decency and respectability in which he's been raised. He's attracted. They tell him that, you know, goodness is fine, but goodness is deadly, dull. And goodness makes for most of the ills of our modern civilization. Well, we need a free man who can climb the heights and breathe the brave air. He's attracted by the possibilities of sin. He begins to ogle the girls as they come down the streets. But he can't sin. He can't join the society. And you watch this non-hero in each of these situations as he confronts the confusions we all confront. He's conscripted into the army. And he's in a skirmish. And he sees all this of the confusion and all of the bloodshed and all of the uncertainty and all of the fury, the violence. And inside his head, you hear his mother speaking the words of responsibility. You see a preacher talking of peace. You see the hopes of the people. He wonders about the lives that are being lost on the other side as well as on our own. Israeli literature has as many themes as any literature. There is the older generation. Their work is done. They've lived in the past. Their greatest contribution was the language itself. There is a modern generation. Their work has really just begun. None of them has reached international stature. One ought not to glorify Israeli literature really beyond its basic merits. There are some interesting stories, and many of the novels are interesting moments, but there's really not a classic novel yet among them. And between these two generations, there is the most fascinating figure of Agnon. His very name describes this in-between situation. In Jewish law, there's a very unfortunate woman known as an Aguna. An Aguna was a deserted wife. The law was that a woman could not initiate a divorce proceeding, and she could not be declared a widow until two witnesses testified to the death of her husband. Now, in ancient times, when men were merchants and took long trips lasting a year or two or three, and they were very, and communication was difficult, men disappeared. And they were gone for 2 years and 3 years. Sometimes they had died, but the woman could not remarry because the supposition was that the man might suddenly come home. He'd been captured. He could be ransomed by some community. And some men after 20 and 25 years did come home, but they were very few. And many of these women lived in childlessness and in premature widowhood far too long. The Aguna is the wife who's been deserted. She is of a place, but she's not alive. Agnon is of Israel, but his world is still the world of Europe. And this man, whom, as you know, in his 80s, a year and a half ago, won the Nobel Prize for Literature, has a fascinating style. He is used far more creatively than most of the Hebrew writers, the Midrashic literature, the Hasidic literature, the Kabbalistic idiom. He writes symbolically. He tells powerful tales. He's created a unique literature of his own, but it's a literature which will not be duplicated because it could be written only by a man who had been immersed as a pious Hasid in one world, found himself by history propelled into another, appreciates that other world, but still lives in the past. There's an old peddler. Somehow all of Agnon's story starts with old peddlers and long, long ago. He's a poor man. Agnon's literature is essentially about poor people. And this old, poor peddler, who works hard for every kopeck he earns, has one ambition. He wants to go up to Israel to die. But he doesn't have the money. He doesn't have the wherewithal. And so he devises a scheme. He will fast 3 days out of every six. No Jew, of course, could fast on the Sabbath. He will manage somehow by not buying every 3 years a new set of clothes to put aside a few coins. But where can a peddler put aside coins in Central Europe? If you've ever been in South Central Europe, you know that along the roadside there are these posts with little shrines at the top. And underneath the shrine there's a poor box. Now most of these poor boxes are rarely gone into. They're technically for the support of this church or that, but there's so little money there. And very often in an out-of-the-way place, these shrines, their little boxes, are left unattended for years and years and years at a time. But the peddler knows of a wood, and in that wood there is a poor box. The poor box was so rusty when he found it that he was sure it had never been opened and would never be opened again. Very few passed, by the way. And every trip, every few months or so, when he came back past this poor box, this roadside shrine, he put in a few coins that he had earned. 20 years passed. Finally, there's enough money in the poor box for his trip to Israel. And he returns, and he opens the box, and as he's opening the box, the police come by. He's taking money consecrated for the church. A terrible crime for a Jew in Eastern Europe. And he's hauled before the magistrate. He doesn't understand any of the proceedings. All he can see in the courtroom is the black figure of the judge, and behind the judge, a crucifix with an icon on it. The icon seems to smile at him, reassurance. And he's sentenced, and he's thrown into the cell. And that night, the icon appears to him and said, "Little peddler, you've been abused. Little peddler, I know you want to go to Israel." And the peddler feels himself lifted above the jail, lifted above the city, wafted along the air. And Adnan concludes the story by saying, the next day, the lifeless body of the peddler was found outside an old yeshiva in Jerusalem. That's a good tale. But what does it mean? Adnan said that he wrote this tale shortly after the signing of the Balfour Declaration. He wrote this tale to tell the Jewish people that unless they're willing to create the state, a few of them will come to Israel, but it'll be a lifeless place. Don't trust the goodwill of the world. You've got to be able to sweat and to sacrifice, or you have nothing. He wrote this before the White Paper of 1929. He wrote it before the White Paper of 1939. He wrote it before the goodwill of Bevin in 1947. He wrote it before the goodwill of the United Nations in 1967. It's a good tale with a good lesson. And that's the kind of writing which Adnan specializes. Perhaps one more tale. You like it. This is a tale of a man and a goat, by Adnan, of course. An old Jew is a peasant in southern Poland. He's worked hard, becomes sick, begins to cough, begins to spit blood, he fears for his life. He goes to the wonder rabbi in the town. They didn't have physicians, and he's told that he'll drink the milk of a goat 3 times a week. He'll be cured. So he buys a goat, and he tethers the goat in his field. And the next day, the goat's gone. And he's absolutely mad. Next day, the goat's still gone. The third day, the goat has returned. The udders of this goat are now filled with milk, and the man milks the goat and drinks the milk and feels refreshed and healed. The goat is again tethered in the field. The next morning, the goat's gone. He's gone for a day and for another, and when he returns, the udder of the goat is again filled, and he drinks of this precious liquid, and he feels again strengthened. He tells the son of this wonderful and strange occurrence. And the son says, "Father, I have an idea. Let's tie a string to the leg of the goat. And I'll tie that string to my wrist. And I'll sleep in the field. And at night, when the goat pulls out the tether and begins to travel, I'll go with the goat, and we'll see where he goes and what happens." And so it happens. Night comes, they tie the back leg of the goat, they tie the wrist to the boy. The boy feels the tug of the goat as the goat begins to move. The goat travels from that field to another, up some mountains, and finally enters a cave. And they stumble, the boy stumbles along behind the goat in this cave, which goes deep into the heart of the mountain. And there at the back of the cave, there's a barely perceptible opening, and the goat goes through that opening, and the boy follows after. And he finds himself suddenly in a sun-kissed land, green, verdant, and lush. And the goat begins to pasture in the field and to drink from a flowing stream. And the boy sees some farmers harvesting their crop in the off to one side. He goes to these farmers and he said, "Where am I and what is this place?" And the farmers answers, "You are in the Holy Land, and this place is near the holy city of Sapit." Now, 100 years ago in Eastern Europe, no Jew who went up to Israel would dream of leaving Israel, because he had been told that something evil would happen to his soul if he ever left the land, emigrated. The boy knows that he's now in a wonderful place. He wants his father to come, but he can't go back and summon his father. So he takes the string that has been tied to the back leg of the goat, and he writes a message to his father: I am in the Holy Land. Follow the goat. Tie a string to his leg as I did, and he will lead you to me. And he ties with this string this message to the horn of the goat. And in a day, the goat is fed and sated and returns, and the boy sits to await his father. The father sees the goat. And the father does not see the boy. And the father is so angry. He's convinced he's lost his son. He takes a scythe that's in his hand, and he kills the goat. And as the goat falls to the ground, the string loosens, and the message falls out. And he reads, follow this goat, and you'll come to the Holy Land. And now John ends by saying, and that day the gates in the cave closed shut, and the way to the Holy Land. It's a good story. But what does it mean? I suspect that it says something that's very true of any immigrant generation. That the father, whether he stays behind or whether he goes, is always left behind. That the adjustment of the immigrant is an almost impossible one in psychological terms. That it is the youth who must rebuild Israel. Israel will be there. The father, if he emigrates, will, in a sense, make it possible for the young. The more probably he will remain behind and send the youth ahead. But immigration is for the young, for those whose values are not set. It's a nice way to get a sociological point across. There you have, I think, a taste of some of the best and some of the more interesting in modern Hebrew literature. Tried to make clear the old generation and its interests, the new generation and some of its interests, those who are in between. We can't deal with a vast range of literature, obviously, in an hour such as this. But I thought we'd conclude by reading to you three poems which translate well. That's one of the reasons for choosing them. Three poems which represent work by the intermediate generation of Jews and young Israeli, of Israeli writers. Each represents a different approach to literature. Each of them will introduce you to a different name and a different writer, and I hope you'll follow these men out and read more of their material. And with Mr. Lazarus's help, we'll begin. The first is written by a man named Zalman Schneer. Born in 1887, died in 1959. The young rebel. He's one of these men who looked on Hebrew as a vehicle of acculturation. Wasn't particularly concerned with its traditional implications. He has a fine poetic hand. He uses the language extremely well. He went to Israel for a few years, but left it quickly. His world was the cosmopolitan world of Europe and of the United States. The poem we're going to read is called The Legend of the Duck. And it has something to say about how men become free spirits. And you'll hear far more of Nietzsche, I believe, in this poem than you will of the God of Abraham. But it's well written and very typical secular literary writing is coterminous with the rebirth of the state itself. We assume that it was the creation of Israel which caused Hebrew to come again alive, to move from a holy language into a living language. This is not the case. Actually, when Israel was first founded, some 80 years ago when the issue began, those settlements, which were sponsored by the Alliance Israelite Universelle, the French settlements, Et Article Région de Sion, spoke French. The German-sponsored settlements spoke German. Those who came to Israel to mourn for the plight of our people and to pray at the Wailing Wall for the early coming of Messiah spoke Yiddish. The small Sephardic settlements spoke either Ladino, the Sephardic Yiddish, Arabic. Hebrew is simply not spoken, except in the synagogue at prayer. Indeed, when 60 years ago, Theodor Herzl wrote a rather romantic, prophetic novel of what the new state would look like, gave a graphic description of its technology and its politics, he neglected to indicate that the people would be speaking Hebrew. He seemed to believe that the Israeli would speak German, his language and the language of technology and engineering 20th century. Point of fact, the rebirth of Hebrew as a spoken tongue, as a vehicle of secular communication, goes back to Central Europe, to the late 18th and early 19th centuries, to a group of intellectuals, a small minority of Jews, who used Hebrew, of all things, as a tool of assimilation. They were determined to bring the Eastern Jewish masses out of their superstitious milieu, out from their ignorance and their meanness of spirit, to open to them the treasuries of Western civilization, which are obviously superior to their way of life. And they selected Hebrew as the vehicle for their instruction. These men were called the Maskilim, the enlightened ones. Pedagogically, they used Hebrew because Hebrew was not too alien to the Jewish mass. Yiddish, when it was written with Hebrew letters. The sound of Hebrew had been heard, and they felt they could sort of sneak in Kant and Hegel and Rousseau if they simply translated their works into Hebrew. And so the revival of Hebrew, surprisingly, is due to the deliberations and machinations of a group of academic Jews who are dissatisfied with the average way of Jewish life, despised Hasidism, who felt that the Jew was in his poor, huddled, shtetl, benighted, medieval, and they looked on Hebrew as one of the key vehicles by which the Jew would be brought into the 19th century. This is readily admitted. One of the late Maskilim, Abraham Geiger, had this to say. Had they written in pure German, these works would have remained incomprehensible. Or if the medium had been the Jewish dialect, he couldn't bring himself to say Yiddish. The growth of the aesthetic spirit would have been stillborn among our kinsmen. Yiddish was looked upon by these Maskilim as an anathema, as having contributed, one said, to the unmannerliness of the common man. Hebrew had the advantage for them of being familiar, at least in sound, and of overleaping in its traditions the entire medieval rabbinic world. Hebrew was associated with biblical times when Jews were kings and princes and when a Jew could stand tall without any restrictions, and also with the so-called Golden Age in Spain in the 10th, 11th, and 12th centuries when the Jew was very much a part of the very highly cultured Arab world of the day. These two images delighted the Maskilim. Kind of Jew who could walk the streets of Paris, and London, and of New York, and feel in no way inferior to the cultivated Westerner, this was their ideal. And Hebrew was the vehicle of their program. So Hebrew begins as a renewed language, as a tool of assimilation. And Hebrew is used during the 19th century as a tool of social criticism. These early Mustilim wrote learned articles, they wrote textbooks and primers in Hebrew. In the middle of the 19th century, a group, small group of Russian Jews began to write novels in Hebrew. And the novels that they wrote were novels of protest, of criticism, of bitter satire. The average theme centered on the court of a tzaddik, one of the wunder rabbis, one of the wonder-working leaders of the Hasidic community around whom all of the Jews thronged, a man who could work miracles and perform faith cures. And the usual theme of the novel was this, that his grandson, who was in line for the succession, would come across a book by a German philosopher or by some scientist, and this book would open to him the magic, the wide horizons of Western civilization, open his eyes to the meanness, the ignorance of the Hasidic court. And he would begin to pull away from his family, pull away from his background. Ultimately, he would flee to Paris. And that's usually where the novel ended. There was a man by the name of S.A. Abramovitz, who was better known among Jews as Mendel Mocher Sforim, Mendel the bookseller. He wrote in Yiddish most of his life, but his first novel was in Hebrew. He was one of these men who sought to criticize the ignorance of the Jewish mass of Eastern Europe. And it was entitled, typically, Fathers and Sons. It dealt with this generational conundrum by the skill or the interest or the talents or the purpose of the writer. The only thing which makes Hebrew literature interesting to us is that it offers us a mirror into the soul of the modern Israeli, and to watch and see how much of its magnetism, of its magic remains, whether as a phenomenon which is associated with so much that is of importance to us in our tradition. It has the power to call men back from the secular world, to call men back from the literary jet set. The people who would far better rather be on the left bank or in Greenwich Village than in Jerusalem. Hebrew then begins not in the land of Israel, but outside of Israel. And Hebrew is learnt in the diaspora and taught to Israel, and taught quite deliberately and for a very practical purpose. The father of modern Hebrew is known as Eliezer ben Yehuda, who's not writing the great, vast Milon dictionary, a term he himself coined from the word Milah, from the term Milah, word, which gave Israel so much of the language and free range in writing that language which it now has. Now, why was Hebrew the one language which could give Israel unity? Well, in the French schools, teachers delighted to teach French, but obviously no good Frenchman would teach German. And in the Hilfsverein schools, where German was the language, every good German teacher immigrated to Israel was delighted to teach German. He was damned if he was going to teach French. And in the yeshivot in Jerusalem, where Yiddish was the language of instruction, Aramaic and Hebrew, an Aramized Hebrew, the language of advanced instruction, they weren't about to learn Arabic. And in the Sephardic community, where they taught their Talmud in Aramaic, Hebrew, and in Arabic, they were not about to learn Yiddish. And so the only way in which you could get any unity was to find a common denominator, the historical denominator, Hebrew. And there were great battles in early Israel about the use of Hebrew as the national language. In the early 1880s, rather, there were a group of secret societies in Israel, of people, nice people, obviously, who had to band together to make agreements that they would speak only Hebrew among themselves, in their families, in the marketplace, wherever they met. Hebrew was almost a subversive language for a while. And then in the 1890s, the teaching profession in Israel began to realize that unless they made a decision on behalf of Hebrew, their best efforts were going to waste. Because all elementary schools were in every single settlement and could be controlled by the settlement. the more advanced schools drew from many settlements, and you had to have a common language, and that common denominator had to be Hebrew. The battle was finally decided in 1913. The Technion in Haifa was established largely by German money and German interest. 1913 represents, as you know, the high water mark of pan-Germanism. The Kaiser was bestride his horse and determined to bestride Europe. And the good German Jewish burghers in Berlin and Hamburg who had given the money for the Technion were determined that the language of instruction in Technion should be German. Well, how did the young boy who had been raised in Petah Tikva in French enroll in the Technion, which at that time was the only advanced school in Israel? And so the teachers in Petah Tikva and Rishon LeZion and in Jerusalem, where Yiddish was a language, went on a general strike. And they said that we won't begin to teach again until we have an agreement that all the schools of higher education in Israel will teach Hebrew. And after some pressure was brought by some people in the United States who didn't speak Hebrew but could see its advantage, the German group finally made a compromise. Physics and chemistry the first year would be taught in Hebrew. After 4 years, all the instruction would be in Hebrew. And that compromise, ending in the triumph of Hebrew, set the seal of the dominance of Hebrew as a language of instruction in Israel. Now there were, of course, men like Eliezer ben Yehuda, and more importantly, Acharam, who in the 1880s and 1890s and 1910s recognized that Hebrew had a value which far transcended any pragmatic consideration. They looked upon Israel not simply as a haven for the refugee, not simply as a place of last resort for those who were not admitted as citizens in any other country, but they looked on it as a great opportunity for Jewry to have a new birth, a renewal. They felt Jews congregating in their own land, determining their destiny, speaking the language of their ancestors, coming to grips with their history, that such a Jewry would give a dramatic new dimension to Jewish life. What about the problem of the shallowness of the idiom? That Hebrew had the Bible, but the Bible is a limited literature. It had the prayer literature, but again, that only derives its vocabulary from one area of life. There was some secular poetry written by the Spanish Jewries of the Middle Ages. But beyond that, Hebrew didn't have the dimension, the breadth, the ambit it required. Acharam used to quote Cato. Cato believed that classical Latin, rather than the popular Roman, must be the language of communication in ancient Rome. And when he was asked, well, how can we express all we need to express in Latin? He answered with the phrase, rem tenor, verba sequentur. First have your original thoughts. That's something to say. You'll find the means to say it. And that proved to be the case. And the way in which Jews carved out a new language is fascinating. Obviously, there were no trains in biblical days, nor in Talmudic days, nor in the medieval times. How do you find a word for a train? Well, you look in the Bible. Obviously, everything's in the Bible. And you find in the Bible the phrase in the prophet Ezekiel, Markevet Esh, which is a word Ezekiel uses when he's in a trance one day and he sees a heavenly vision and there's a chariot of fire. Markevet Esh. Well, there were some purists who were a little troubled by this because Ezekiel didn't mean a train when he spoke of a Markevet Esh. And they coined the word, Tahalucha, which means the self-propelled. It comes from the word halak, to go. But a lot of things in modern life are self-propelled. So this didn't quite satisfy anybody. Somebody else began writing about Shurat Masa, the rails that carry you along. Well, that satisfied people for a while, but finally they weren't satisfied either with that, and they came to the word which is used today, simply Rakevet, which is a shortening of the Ezekiel term, and has something of the sound of the wheels and the pistons moving along, the train clatters over the tracks. Hebrew is a fascinating language. Some words in Hebrew are borrowings, direct borrowings from English. The word tragedy in Hebrew is tragedia. Some words have borrowing from two languages. You know what they call in Hebrew a man who manages to find his way through the intricacies of the bureaucracy? He manages to get behind the desk to know what's going on. It's called a jobnik. the English job, almost from the way the burglaries now have a job to do. And Nick is a Slavic, you know, a person who does something. Or you take the word in Hebrew for a motor scooter. You know the word katan, small. Noah means to move about. They created a blender together, katnoah, a little thing that scoots about. And you get the word scooter. Well, Hebrew developed, obviously, out of necessity, its own language. It was easier to develop Hebrew than it would have been to develop English, because English is a very complicated language. And Hebrew, basically, is a very regular language. All words come from certain three rooted letters, three basic letters. And you can make nouns and verbs and adjectives and adverbs out of the same letters. The Hebrew had a great deal of built-in flexibility to it. And the poets and writers of Israel have exploited that flexibility to the utmost. Hebrew, I said, in its origin was a language revived in order to acculture the Jew to the 20th century. And for the first part of its history, that's precisely one of the functions it performed. Most books which have been written in Hebrew, the overwhelming majority, are translations from all languages of the world. They say that there are some 2,000 books which are published in Israel every year. Well over 1,500 of these are translations. And if you go into any Tel Aviv or Jerusalem bookstore, you can find everything from Shakespeare to James Bond and probably some of the lesser desired works which appear on our bestseller list. If we wanted to go to theater in Israel tonight, we were in Tel Aviv, you know what our choice would be? At the Habima, they're showing Terence Rattigan's Separate Tables in Hebrew. At the Chamber Theater, the Kameri, they're showing Clifford Odets' Country Girl in Hebrew. And what we would call it off-Broadway theater, they're showing a Hebrew program called Love and All That Jazz. The Hebrew University publishes a series of occasional papers, which is called the Scripta, the last volume of which was done by the literary faculty of the Department of Humanities and included long essays on Brecht's Waiting for Godot, on Chekhov's The Cherry Orchard. The Israeli literary world is international and cosmopolitan. Hebrew is a language which does not limit the Jew to his time and his place, the small country of Israel, or to his tradition. But it has built into it a tradition. And the tension between the history of the language and the desire of those who use the language to be heard far beyond the borders of Israel is one of the great tensions of modern Israeli literature. One of the characters you meet and you become familiar with in Israeli novels is a young man of Bohemian type, verbal, vocal, creative, who inhabits the bistros of Tel Aviv, who wants to use his native language but wants to have very little to do with the past or even with the present. He wants to write of love. He wants to write in the style of Kafka or the style of Brecht or in the non-style of some of our modern writers. And he feels restricted by the language, restricted by the audience he can appeal to because of the language he uses. But most of all, he'd much rather be on the left bank or in Greenwich Village, really, than in Tel Aviv. And there are these uprooted people among Israeli intelligentsia, writers, young writers, quite as much as there are such people, obviously, in the United States and elsewhere. Indeed, from the very beginning, there were Jews who caught the assimilative capacity of the Hebrew language and tried to use it, still, in Israel, as a vehicle to force the Jew into a different mold. Among the great pioneers of modern Hebrew literature is a poet translated by the name of Saul Chernohorsky. Chernohorsky was born in Russia. He was tutored in Hebrew at an early age. But from his early age to his death, he keeps referring to himself as a strange plant among his fellow Jews. He couldn't feel at home. He lived in an age in which men delighted to say that there's such a thing as a Hellene and such a thing as a Hebrew. There's a Jewish tradition and a Greek tradition. The Greek tradition exalts nature and the sensual and the aesthetic. The Jewish tradition exalts obedience to God, meditation, sanctification, the intellectual, the introspective. He opted for the Greek. One of his great series of poems is called Sonnets of a Pagan. He spent a great deal of his life translating into Hebrew the Iliad, the Odyssey, the Rig Veda, the Icelandic Eddas, Moliere, Racine, Goethe, Shakespeare, you name it, he translated it. He was determined that he was going to bring to Israel and bring to the Hebrew-speaking Jew the entire glory of Western civilization. He seemed to believe that this was his purpose to being, and being something of a genius, he had the language, the skill with which to do it. His descendants, there are many. Many who feel that they'd like to use Hebrew to join the Western world, not to be separated out by it. And there are many who, though they are Sabras, Israeli born, and though they are fully Israeli, believe that there is nothing which they share with the entire range of tradition which somehow Hebrew symbolizes. There's a small group of writers who call themselves the Canaanites. They won't be called Israelis. They won't be called Jews. They're pagans, and they're proud of it. They're heathens, Canaanites, those whom our ancestors pushed away because they worshiped nature gods, because they had sexual rites associated with their temples. Well, they delight in the physical and in the natural, and they delight in the idea that they are pagans. But have you ever seen a Jewish pagan? You've seen quite a beast. Now, Hebrew, modern Israeli literature, it seems to me, divides essentially into two basic generations. There's an immigrant generation, which comes early or late in its life, generally having learned Hebrew in the diaspora, which has more or less capacity to control the language, but whose entire thought world is conditioned by the European environment. The greatest of the Hebrew writers, Chaim Nachman Bialik, is such a man. Bialik was born in the Pale of the Settlement. Bialik learned Hebrew as in his own way. He carved out a living language for himself. He wrote his greatest poetry before he came to Israel. And even when he was in Israel, his themes tended to revert back to the Matmidi, to the perpetual student whom he remembered from the yeshiva in Volozhin, to the unmarked graves of the martyrs of the Kishinev pogrom. His world was the world of the Jewry that he knew. And you don't find in him the exaltation of the new Jew, a homeless in Zion. He's still at home in the old world. And then there's a new generation, a generation of young writers who are born in Israel, who came to Israel sufficiently young so they feel rooted. And they look at the world from an entirely different perspective. They ask the questions, what does it mean to me as an Israeli, rather than what does it mean to me as a European Jew? No problem has disturbed Jewry the world over as much as the problem of the Holocaust, the destruction of such millions. How do you relate to it? How can you relate to it? The elderly generation set up lamentations. They bewailed the martyrs. They remembered the streets of the cities in which they had born. They saw ghosts walking those streets. The younger generation wondered about its own reactions, being trained to be those who will avenge indignity to the Jewish people. And so you had a man like Hanoch Bartok, who wrote a prize-winning novel several years ago, which has been translated into English under the title The Brigade. He tells an interesting story. You see the unit in the Palestine Brigade of the Jews who fought in the British Army during the Second World War. V-Day has taken place. There's been triumph in Europe. And this unit, which has been in Italy, has been ordered into Germany as part of the Army of Occupation. And when these orders come down, you feel an electric excitement through the troops. And one of them says, we're going to have a wild Jewish revenge. For once, we're going to be the Cossacks. We're going to be the Tartars. We're going to be the Germans. And they finger their guns, and their hands are on the trigger, And you go with this unit as in its lorry as it approaches Germany, and you can see that they're waiting for that first moment when they're free of their officers. The blood is in their eyes. They're Canaanites. They're not Jews anymore. They're not going to take it anymore. And then you watch the young protagonist of the story. His name is Elias. He stomps off to town, his carbine over his shoulder. A German approaches him and whispers to him, "That house over there, it belongs to an officer of the SS. He's away, and his wife and daughter are there." He thinks of rape. He thinks of attack. He thinks of vengeance. He kicks in the door of the house. And there's the woman and her daughter cowering in the kitchen. And he finds out that he's not so much a Canaanite. He finds the only thing he asks this woman, though the urge for vengeance is in every throb of his heart, is for a room to stay in for the night, clean sheets, something he hasn't had during the war. He goes upstairs to the child's room, he and a buddy, and during the night they hear noises downstairs. Other non-Israeli members of the Army of Occupation have entered the house and they're wrestling with these women. And despite himself, he finds himself going downstairs and ordering these men out of the house, his gun in hand, and protecting these members of the SS. He's not convinced, Elias or Bakta, that this is a heroic act. He's not convinced that he's not a coward. He's not convinced that this overlay of civilization is good. But he is convinced that he can't be the pagan. And in that tension, you have a very, very effective and dramatic story, and something which I think explains what we saw in June of this year after the victory of the Six-Day War. You have two generations then, a generation whose emotional world remains the world of Europe, and a generation whose emotional world is now the new world of Israel, seeking its own roots. The first generation, when it comes to Israel, if it deals with an Israeli thing, deals with it idyllically. There's the past. Here I can walk through Jerusalem, I can walk through Modin, where Mattathias raised the rebellion of the Maccabees. You have men who write the great historical romances of the past. In the new generation, you have the men who wonder whether they really want to live under the burden of the past. It's a fascinating book which has been written in Israel called Hachai Al Hamet, by a man who is in his 50s today. Hachai Al Hamet means the living upon the dead. The Megan who wrote this book sets up the situation. There's a young Tel Aviv bohemian. He claims to have no values. He's an existentialist. He believes only in himself and in the moment. But you've got to live. And he finds after a while that his money is running out, and he's quick with a pen, facile. And a publisher approaches him to write a biography of one of the great pioneers. And he takes a rather sizable advance and puts him back in food and in liquor. And he feels that he can toss off this biography in a matter of days. So he goes back to his haunts at night, and during the day he does some desultory work in the library, and he meets some of those who knew this pioneer. The living on the dead. Now the dead man was a man who knew how to sacrifice. He's a very simple, heroic kind of figure. He left his European background. He came and with his hands he worked the soil. Out of his sweat he made one of the kibbutzim green. He kept the people together. He gave them life. He gave them encouragement. There was an unusual dignity to this man. And this young cynic, despite himself, is attracted by the tradition. Attracted by the past. And the more he vacillates between these two worlds, the very effete, very sophisticated world of the youth, and the rather simple, open-air, pioneering world of his subject, the more he becomes confused, filled with self-doubt, and in fact, paralyzed. He's called Jonas, and the name is symbolic. Symbolic, of course, of the prophet Jonah, the prophet who was sent to Nineveh to tell the people of Nineveh that they are to die, and when the people repent, and God did to recall his decision. Remember Nineveh, Jonah complains of God's change of heart. But Jonah, when the first call had come early in their story, tried to flee from it. There's no call of God in this story. Rather, there's a court summons. The publisher has gone to court. He demands something for the advance he has given the writer. And young Jonas is told to sit down and to complete his assignment. But he's paralyzed. The story ends in that sense of paralysis. This young generation is as sophisticated as any. The Hebrew, the Bible, the tradition, the pioneers of the earlier generation, somehow they cannot be escaped. And many a modern Israeli writer, younger writer, I think, finds himself in that tradition. Of course, among the modern Israeli authors are a number who deal with themes which are common to Western civilization, for after all, the urbanization, the growing academic requirements, the growing specialization of the city, as much a part of Cleveland as of Tel Aviv, Haifa as of New York. There's another story about Megid, which is a rather fascinating one, which deals with this kind of universal theme. It's called The Fool. And the non-hero, because most of modern fiction has the non-hero, the little man, caught in the web of his time, unsure, confused, pushed here, pushed there, having only a flicker of inner dignity veiled largely from him by his own confusion. This little non-hero seeks to find his way in a confusing world. Now, the modern Israeli lives not on the kibbutz, but in the city. And his world is not the world of those who broke the stone and made the hills green. His world is the world of the auditors and of the secretaries and of the bureaucrats and of the technicians and of the engineers who build the sinews of a modern state. Now, the fool is an auditor, very low in some office. And he sees all about him bright young people being very sophisticated, being very superior to the traditional values. He begins to wonder about these values. He's not sure if it's a dream or if it's reality. He suddenly sees a group of rather middle-class people coming together for a meeting. There's a secretary, there's a president. Somebody calls for the minutes to be read. Somebody complains their name isn't spelled properly. And it's a society for the promulgation of sin. It's the reverse of the ordinary decency and respectability in which he's been raised. He's attracted. They tell him that, you know, goodness is fine, but goodness is deadly, dull. And goodness makes for most of the ills of our modern civilization. Well, we need a free man who can climb the heights and breathe the brave air. He's attracted by the possibilities of sin. He begins to ogle the girls as they come down the streets. But he can't sin. He can't join the society. And you watch this non-hero in each of these situations as he confronts the confusions we all confront. He's conscripted into the army. And he's in a skirmish. And he sees all this, the confusion and all of the bloodshed and all of the uncertainty and all of the fury, the violence. And inside his head, you see them, you hear his mother speaking the words of responsibility. You see a preacher talking of peace. You see the hopes of the people. He wonders about the lives that are being lost on the other side as well as on our own. Israeli literature has as many themes as any literature. There is the older generation. Their work is done. They've lived in the past. Their greatest contribution was the language itself. There is a modern generation. Their work has really just begun. None of them has reached international stature. One ought not to glorify Israeli literature really beyond its basic merits. There's some interesting stories, and many of the novels are interesting moments, but there's really not a classic novel yet among them. And between these two generations, there is the most fascinating figure of Adnan. His very name describes this in-between situation. In Jewish law, there's a very unfortunate woman known as an Aguna. An Aguna was a deserted wife. The law was that a woman could not initiate a divorce proceeding, and she could not be declared a widow until two witnesses testified to the death of her husband. Now, in ancient times, when men were merchants and took long trips lasting a year or two or three, and they were communication was difficult, men disappeared. And they were gone for 2 years and 3 years. Sometimes they had died, but the woman could not remarry because the supposition was that the man might suddenly come home. He'd been captured. He could be ransomed by some community. And some men after 20 and 25 years did come home, but they were very few. And many of these women lived in childlessness and in premature widowhood far too long. The Aguna is the wife who's been deserted. She's of a place, but she's not alive. Adnan is of Israel, but his world is still the world of Europe. And this man, whom, as you know, in his 80s, a year and a half ago, won the Nobel Prize for Literature, has a fascinating style. He has used far more creatively than most of the Hebrew writers the Midrashic literature, the Hasidic literature, the Kabbalistic idiom. He writes symbolically. He tells powerful tales. He's created a unique literature of his own, but it's a literature which will not be duplicated because it could be written only by a man who had been immersed as a pious Hasid in one world, found himself by history propelled into another, appreciates that other world, but still lives in the past. There's an old peddler. Somehow all of Adnan's story starts with old peddlers and long, long ago. He's a poor man. And Adnan's literature is essentially about poor people. And this old, poor peddler, who works hard for every kopeck he earns, has one ambition. He wants to go up to Israel to die. But he doesn't have the money. He doesn't have the wherewithal. And so he devises a scheme. He will fast 3 days out of every six. No Jew, of course, could fast on the Sabbath. He will manage somehow by not buying every 3 years a new set of clothes to put aside a few coins. But where can a peddler put aside coins in Central Europe? If you've ever been in South Central Europe, you know that along the roadside there are these posts with little shrines at the top. And underneath the shrine there's a poor box. Now most of these poor boxes are rarely gone into. They're technically for the support of this church or that, but there's so little money there. And very often, in an out-of-the-way place, these shrines, their little boxes, are left unattended for years and years and years at a time. And the peddler knows of a wood, and in that wood there's a poor box, and the poor box was so rusty when he found it that he was sure it had never been opened and would never be opened again. Very few passed, by the way. And every trip, every few months or so, when he came back past this poor box, this roadside shrine, he put in a few coins that he had earned. 20 years pass. Finally, there's enough money in the poor box for his trip to Israel. And he returns, and he opens the box. And as he's opening the box, the police come by. He's taking money consecrated for the church. A terrible crime for a Jew in Eastern Europe. And he's hauled before the magistrate. He doesn't understand any of the proceedings. All he can see in the courtroom is the black figure of the judge, and behind the judge, a crucifix with an icon on it. And the icon seems to smile at him, reassurance. And he's sentenced, and he's thrown into the cell. And that night, the icon appears to him and said, "Little peddler, you've been abused. Little peddler, I know you want to go to Israel." And the peddler feels himself lifted above the jail, lifted above the city, wafted along the air. And Adnan concludes the story by saying, the next day, the lifeless body of the peddler was found outside an old yeshiva in Jerusalem. That's a good tale. But what does it mean? Adnan said that he wrote this tale shortly after the signing of the Balfour Declaration. He wrote this tale to tell the Jewish people that unless they're willing to create the state, a few of them will come to Israel, but it'll be a lifeless place. Don't trust the goodwill of the world. You've got to be able to sweat and to sacrifice, or you'll have nothing. He wrote this before the White Paper of 1929. He wrote it before the White Paper of 1939. He wrote it before the goodwill of Bevin in 1947. He wrote it before the goodwill of the United Nations in 1967. It's a good tale with a good lesson. And that's the kind of writing which Adnan specializes. Perhaps one more tale, if you like it. This is a tale of a man and a goat. By Adnan, of course. An old Jew was a peasant in southern Poland. He's worked hard, becomes sick. He begins to cough. He has to spit blood. He fears for his life. He goes to the one rabbi in the town. They didn't have physicians, and he's told that he'll drink the milk of a goat 3 times a week. He'll be cured. So he purpies a goat, and he tethers the goat in his field. And the next day, the goat's gone. And he's absolutely mad. Next day, the goat's still gone. The third day, the goat has returned. The udders of this goat are now filled with milk, and the man milks the goat and drinks the milk, and he feels refreshed and healed. The goat is again tethered in the field. The next morning, the goat's gone. He's gone for a day and for another. And when he returns, the udder of the goat is again filled, and he drinks of this precious liquid, and he feels again strengthened. He tells his son of this wonderful and strange occurrence. And the son says, "Father, I have an idea. Let's tie a string to the leg of the goat. And I'll tie that string to my wrist. And I'll sleep in the field. And at night, when the goat pulls out the tether and begins to travel, I'll go with the goat, and we'll see where he goes and what happens." And so it happens. Night comes, they tie the back leg of the goat, they tie the wrist to the boy. The boy feels the tug of the goat as the goat begins to move. The goat travels from that field to another, up some mountains, and finally enters a cave. And they stumble, the boy stumbles along behind the goat in this cave which goes deep into the heart of the mountain. And there at the back of the cave, there's a barely perceptible opening, and the goat goes through that opening, and the boy follows after. And he finds himself suddenly in a sun-kissed land, green, verdant, and lush. And the goat begins to pasture in the field to drink from a flowing stream. And the boy sees some farmers harvesting their crop in the off to one side, and he goes to these farmers and he said, "Where am I and what is this place?" And the farmers answers, "You are in the Holy Land, and this place is near the holy city of Safed." 100 years ago in Eastern Europe, no Jew who went up to Israel would dream of leaving Israel, because he had been told that something evil would happen to his soul if he ever left the land, emigrated. The boy knows that he's now in a wonderful place. He wants his father to come, but he can't go back and summon his father. So he takes the string that has been tied to the back leg of the goat, and he writes a message to his father, "I am in the Holy Land. Follow the goat. Tie a string to his leg as I did, and he will lead you to me." And he ties with this string this message to the horn of the goat. And in a day, the goat is fed and sated and returns, and the boy sits to await his father. The father sees the goat. The father does not see the boy. And the father is so angry, he's convinced he's lost his son, he takes a scythe that's in his hand, and he kills the goat. As the goat falls to the ground, the string loosens and the message falls out. And he reads, follow this goat, and you'll come to the Holy Land. And Adnan ends by saying, and that day the gate in the cave closed shut, and the way to the Holy Land closed. It's a good story. But what does it mean? I suspect that it says something that's very true of any immigrant generation. That the father, whether he stays behind or whether he goes, is always left behind. That the adjustment of the immigrant is an almost impossible one in psychological terms. That it is the youth who must rebuild Israel. Israel will be theirs. The father, if he emigrates, will, in a sense, make it possible for the young. And more probably, he will remain behind and send the youth ahead. But immigration is for the young, for those whose values are not set. Nice way to get a sociological point across. But there you have, I think, a taste of some of the best and some of the more interesting and modern Hebrew literature, tried to make clear the old generation and its interests, the new generation and some of its interests, those who are in between. You can't deal with a vast range of literature, obviously, in an hour such as this. But I thought we'd conclude by reading to you three poems which translate well. This is one of the reasons for choosing them. Three poems which represent work by the intermediate generation of Jews, of young Israeli, of Israeli writers. Each represents a different approach to literature. Each of them will introduce you to a different name and a different writer, and I hope you'll follow these men out and read more of their material. And with Mr. Lazarus's help, we'll begin. The first is written by a man named Zalman Schneer. Born in 1887, died in 1959. A young rebel. He's one of these men who looked on Hebrew as a vehicle of acculturation. Wasn't particularly concerned with its traditional implications. He has a fine poetic hand. He uses the language extremely well. He went to Israel for a few years, but left it quickly. His world was the cosmopolitan world of Europe and of the United States. The poem we're going to read is called The Legend of the Duck. It has something to say about how men become free spirits. And you'll hear far more of Nietzsche, I believe, in this poem than you will of the God of Abraham. But it's well written and very typical of the old modern critical standards. And that's what I'm trying to do, to make you understand this. Revelation is a basic tenet of Judaism. The Judaism insisted, the Hebrew Orthodox Judaism tradition, only on the revelation of the law. When an Orthodox boy, 100, 200 years ago, when any Jewish boy at that time was sent to read the Bible, you know where he began? Have any idea? He began with Leviticus 1. And Leviticus 1 is about as dry, uninteresting a part as you can possibly have. Has to do with temporal rules, regulations, one thing or another. When any man of you bringeth an offering unto the Lord, he shall bring your offering of the cattle, even of the herd, of the flock. That's the first law in the first sentence, really, of Leviticus. That you're supposed to bring sacrifices and feasts. Now, why did we begin there rather than the stories of Genesis, which are much easier reading, better Hebrew to start off with, much more exciting to youngsters? Because the piety of Jewish life insisted on the authority, on the revealed authority of Jewish law. The so-called 613 commandments in the Bible. It never insisted on the same degree of revelation for these early
legends and tales. It's all great reading, isn't it? An Orthodox person would say that these first chapters of the Bible must be read midrashically, which means this way, reading in and reading out, interpretively. I know none except the Persian Yeshiva kind, who insists on a literal interpretation. And certainly in Maimonides, Halevi, the great rabbis in the Middle Ages would not have insisted on the literal interpretation of these first chapters. There has never been a dogma in Jewish life, unlike that of Christian life. We insisted on the dogmatics of the law. That's a big difference of Christianity. We insist on discipline, on law, on rules and regulations. The advantages and disadvantages. That's what Sinai means to us. The Torah means law. The legendary part, the historical part, the quasi-historical